Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassay and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On this week's show, we'll talk literature with three Canadian writers. We'll first stop in Russell, Ontario to meet up with writer Phil Gursky. He's a local writer whose self-published book tells the story of over 100 men who left Russell to fight in the First World War.
What would drive men from a very small, I'm talking 600 to 800 people back in 1914, to essentially drop everything, leave their wives, their parents, their children, and sign up to go fight in Europe? And as it turned out, there were over 160 men who did go fight in Europe for Canada.
And then to Toronto City Book Awards that just unveiled this year's long list of 13 writers. We'll be hearing from two of them, writer and physician Vincent Lam, who published On the Ravine, and Sheila Murray, who released her first novel, Finding Edward.
For me, I need to enter the character of Claire, the violinist, who is struggling with opioids. I need to enter the character of Chen, the doctor, who is trying to help this patient. And I need to be walking in the ravines of Toronto, where these worlds meet.
I still believe that while everything seems to change, many things don't. And in terms of what it means to be brown, I think that's a conversation that needs to be ongoing. And it's really obviously an important question.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide. Hello and thanks for being with us, the writer and former CSIS strategist, Phil Gursky, just published his latest book, From Village to Vimy to Victory, Russell Soldiers in the Great War. It came out in early June. Gursky moved to Russell, Ontario from Ottawa a few years ago and became interested in the historic sacrifice made in his new hometown by young men in the First World War. The self-published book, printed by the Printing House in Ottawa, tells the story of over 100 men who left Russell to fight in the First World War. 19 did not return. At the time, the town of Russell only had about 600 people, so a large portion of the population left, Gursky noted, and of those who returned, many suffered from the other scars of war. The book chronicles some of their experiences, including how their lives unfolded when they came home. The village of Russell is located less than a half hour away from Ottawa. Some 4,000 people, mostly Anglophones, live and work there now, or in the nearest town, for example, of Embrun. From Russell, here's Phil Gursky's conversation with journalist Candice Vedder.
Hello, bonjour, and welcome to Local First. I'm Candice Vedder, and today I'm speaking with local author Phil Gursky, who's going to tell us about his latest book and some of the other books he has out. Hi, Phil. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Candice, for having me on the program. It's a real honor to be with you today.
Oh, that's really nice that you're saying that. It's an honor for us to have you. Your latest book just came out recently. What's the title and what's it about?
So this latest book came out a few months ago. It is called From Village to Vimy to Victory, Russell Soldiers in the Great War. And it really is the story of the men from Russell, Ontario, who signed up to fight with what was called the Canadian Expeditionary Forces, or CEF, beginning in 1914, to go over to Europe and basically fight for Canada and the British Empire, because, of course, Britain was at war with Germany in 1914. And I wanted to sort of look into the background of what would drive men from a very small, I'm talking 600 to 800 people back in 1914, to essentially drop everything, leave their wives, their parents, their children, and sign up to go fight in Europe. And as it turned out, there were over 160 men who did go fight in Europe for Canada, 19 of whom didn't make it back. They died. So it was just an effort to try and look at what Russell was like in 1914, what some of the motivations were for the men who did go to fight, and equally as importantly, what happened when they came home? Did they return to their lives? Were they injured, et cetera, et cetera? So it's basically a snapshot of it. What I think is a typical Eastern Ontario, maybe even Canadian village in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, I had no idea that so many men had gone to the First World War from such a small place. It's quite astonishing. But I mean, there was that kind of fervor at the time to go fight for the motherland or something like that, right?
Well, exactly. So the initial call was for 25,000 soldiers supporters in 1914, and that was vastly oversubscribed. There were well over 35,000 that signed up. By the end of 1918, fully more than 625,000 Canadians had gone to fight in the war, and it was about a 10th attrition rate. About 50,000 died. You know, I think that, you know, we're speaking here, you know, over 100 years after the First World War was declared, we see war very differently right now, and I think rightfully so. Back in 1914, it was seen as an adventure. You mentioned, you know, going to fight for king and country. There was a sense of patriotism, a sense of doing the right thing. And I don't think we have that same perspective on war anymore. But again, you got to bear in mind, this is a very small village. So about a quarter of the population left to go fight in the war. And for them, it would have been something that they needed to do and wanted to do. And I think it's one of the main motivations why they went in the first place.
Yeah, that's really interesting what motivated them. And also, I like that you've gotten into what happened when they came back, because that was there was a real shift in society at that time.
Absolutely. I think people had no idea about, this was the first modern war in a sense that you had massive killing machines. Of course, you had machine guns, you had aircraft, you had the invention of the tank in the First World War. This was a war where people, they fought with 19th century attitudes against 20th century weapons. This is why the slaughter was so indescribable. I remember one of the motivations for writing the book was I was in France in 2015, it happened to be at the site where it was the Battle of Beaumont-Hamel in 1916, the first battle of the Somme. And then the Newfoundland Regiment, of course, Newfoundland wasn't part of Canada back then. The Newfoundland Regiment went over the top under the trenches, expecting to walk across the fields to fight the Germans, and about 90% were slaughtered in the first 20 minutes. So a lot of these men came back with horrific physical injuries, including amputations, because of course the medical care wasn't quite what it was today. In addition, mental afflictions, which people didn't understand back then. They didn't understand PTSD. They didn't understand shell shock. So I think for a lot of these men, it was like, okay, I'm home now, and now what do I do? And I also found out that very few of the men would share their experiences with their families. It's not that they were ashamed, but they wanted to put that behind them. And they probably felt their families wouldn't understand what it's like to live in a trench for 6 months with the rats and the lice and the cold and the mud and things like that. So a lot came back and did well, became bank managers, went back to the farm, opened businesses. But I'm sure a lot of them had an awful lot of psychological and spiritual trauma that was never really understood by their families back home.
Well, and when they came home too, it was different. I mean, women had taken over a lot of the men's jobs. Attitudes had changed. Clothing had changed. Women were wearing pants. They maybe didn't want to have disabled men come home and start telling them what to do again or something like that.
I think so. And a lot of them were farmers. And so when they left, their wives took over the farms and they would have basically had to run them. And you're right. Society had changed. Many people say that Canada was born on the battlefield of World War One. It became a different nation as a consequence. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not so true, but you're absolutely right. The First World War engendered a lot of changes in society, you know, followed by a depression after the war, which hit Russell pretty hard. Luckily, no one died, but only I think a different world to which they return. The sheer horror of World War One, you can sort of put behind them, but the world went on. And then, of course, 20 years later, we had the horrors of World War Two.
I know, it's hard to imagine. We don't have a lot of time, so tell us about your other books. I mean, you've really written, like you really get into some of the nitty gritty of the hard parts of society.
In Canada, 32 years. Part of my job was working at CSIS, so the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and Counterterrorism. So my first six books are all about terrorism, understanding it from a Canadian angle, from an intelligence angle, trying to explain what terrorism is. My next to most recent book before this book on Russell Soldiers was an actual comprehensive history of terrorism in Canada from Confederation to the present called The Peaceable Kingdom. So this is a bit of a stretch for me, but it's also, it kind of marries my interest in local history with my desire to understand Russell better. And so I'll keep writing. It seems to me my retirement is all about writing books. See what happens later on.
Did you get any flack after you wrote the book from former colleagues at CSIS?
No, because I had vetted the manuscript with them. That's a kind of something we have to do. I want to make sure I wasn't disclosing any information that was not in the public domain. And as a consequence, I had to basically let them know what I was writing. And I guess to my credit, I suppose, they liked it. They didn't change any of the words. I was very careful to use open sources. Obviously, my interpretation of the open sources, but the information on the public domain.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add before we sign off?
No, you know what? I moved to Russell almost 3 years ago. I love living out here. It's amazing. Learn more about it through going to the Russell Historical Society, researching the book on the First World War. And it's just a real treat to understand more what this village has been through. Of course, we're now celebrating the 125th anniversary of the Place Village of Russell, dating back to 1898. And so I think it's a celebration of what Russell stands for.
Thanks. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Phil. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Candace.
I'm Candace Vetter.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You're tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJR.
There will be new and familiar faces at this year's Toronto Book Awards that just unveiled its 2023 long list. Out of the 105 submissions it received, 13 books made it into the final stage. The winners of the Book Awards will be announced in October. The Book Awards are organized and created by the City of Toronto and have been running for 49 years. They honor books of literary merit that are inspired by the city or from Toronto writers. There are no separate categories for fiction and nonfiction, with the list being open to all types of literary works. The potential winner of the awards can earn a total of $15,000 in prize pool money. The only thing that the nominees have in common is their connection to the City of Toronto. A notable return to the long list is 2007's finalist and award-winning author Vincent Lam, with his new novel, On the Ravine. Journalist Owen Thompson had a chance to sit down with two of this year's writers and finalists, Vincent Lam and Sheila Murray. But first, Lam. He now talks about how his work as a doctor and physician crosses over into his writing.
Both medicine and writing are about human stories. They're about the journeys that each of us are taking through the world, through our own lives. And then, of course, there are differences. In medicine, what happens generally is that people bring me some sort of problem they're facing and privilege me with being involved in trying to address that problem and trying to help in their journey. Writing, of course, I just, you know, come across the problems myself and then have to solve my own problems. So they're ultimately both narrative arts and they're ultimately both engaged in the world, I think, in a very important way.
And so this brings me to your latest novel, On the Ravine, which follows a doctor who is in the addictions field and, I guess, a patient who has recently suffered two overdoses. With this novel, are you drawing from your, I guess, fairly recent work at this addictions clinic?
On the Ravine is definitely situated in a world that I know very well. It's situated in the world of the current opioid crisis. And while it's situated in that world, it's very much a work of fiction. In this new novel, On the Ravine, two of the characters from Bloodletting and Miraculous Cures, two of the doctors, Chen and Fitzgerald, return. And they're a little bit more experienced in the world. They have a different vantage point on certain things, and their relationship has evolved. And within this particular point in time, there is also a patient who comes into both of their lives. And this patient, whose name is Claire, is a gifted and wonderful violinist who wants deeply to make beautiful music. And she has also had opioids come into her life, and opioids are affecting her in very serious and difficult ways. And so this is really a novel about people of medicine trying to help this young violinist and trying to grapple with a city, Toronto, which is also coming to terms with this really serious problem.
And how much of your personal and work life bleeds into your latest work?
Well, On the Ravine is absolutely a fictional work, and it's one in which I know the world because I inhabit the world. And I think that's really how many writers work. We understand the world that we live in, and we understand a lot of what ifs. And so that's often the territory that I inhabit. Things may happen a certain way in my actual work as a doctor, and then I may be left wondering, well, what if? You know, what if things happened slightly differently? Or what if things happened in a way that was surprising, or in some way expressive of a hope that I have. And that is really the territory that I'd have. But when I'm writing about a world which I know, but which is a world of fiction, it's very much a process in which I really need to enter the world of the fictional place that I'm writing about. So I really needed to inhabit the world of On the Ravine, which, of course, is set in Toronto. But when you write a book, the world of the book is also its own thing. And so for me, I need to enter the character of Claire, the violinist who is struggling with opioids. I need to enter the character of Chen, the doctor who is trying to help this patient and trying to do the best that he can. And yet he's coming up against obstacles. And I need to be walking in the ravines of Toronto where these worlds meet for Chen and Claire and Fitz.
What do you do to get into that headspace to write?
Well, mostly I just work. You know, like it's such a it's such a non-romantic, non-sexy answer, but yeah, you know, I sit down and I work, I write, and sometimes I sit down and I write and I really don't feel like it, and through the work I get there. And sometimes I feel really moved to do something and I can't wait to sit down and it really comes to life exactly as I'd hoped. And sometimes I feel really excited about the work. I've got this great idea. And when I sit down, you know, it kind of doesn't work and I have to change my plans. For me, writing is very much this process of me engaging with thoughts, imagination, this world, and just doing it through work, you know, just working away at it until it becomes what I imagine and what I hope it could be. And so that's my process. And that was certainly my process for On the Ravine. The thing which is really amazing for me, for all the books that I've written, is that at the end of that process, you know, which is very much kind of a sit down and do the work sort of process, at the end of it, it seems to coalesce in this way that feels right. It seems to coalesce as if it was just meant to be that way. The getting there was lots of just plain old work. This is an exploration of the human experience of opioid use disorder. And that is an incredibly visceral and incredibly difficult human journey. And so inherently that's difficult to write about. And I think because it's a difficult journey, it's also a journey that people need to have an appreciation for in its full human expression, its full human hope, as well as suffering. So for me, that is really one of the most important roles of fiction, to be able to inhabit human experiences. And so I hope that On the Ravine inhabits the deeply human experiences of people who are experiencing opioid use disorder and those who are trying to help folks who use opioids and who are experiencing opioid use disorder. It's a book which speaks to me on many levels, and I hope that On the Ravine will speak to readers who are interested in both of these issues, who are, yes, interested in issues around substance use and opioid use disorder, but who are also interested in a beautifully talented young violinist who is trying to make her way in the world, and an idealistic doctor who is trying to do his best. And his friend, also a doctor, who has his own challenges and is trying to navigate them. And so this is what novels give us.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
We continue with the Toronto Book Awards in the company of writer Sheila Murray, who published her first novel. Murray has made it onto the Book Awards long list with her debut novel, Finding Edward. Released in 2022, Finding Edward took Murray over 10 years to write and multiple drafts. Murray currently lives in Hamilton, Ontario, but lived in Toronto for decades before she moved. While aware of the awards, she was surprised to find out she made it to the long list. Here she is speaking with Owen Thompson about her book.
So Finding Edward is about a young man who arrives from Jamaica. He's around 20 when he gets to Toronto from Jamaica. What you need to know about him is that he comes not because he'd wanted to particularly, but because everybody thought it would be the best thing for him to do after his mother died. And he's mixed race. His dad was white, English, and his mom black Jamaican, and his dad left the family when Cyril, who was the name of the 20-year-old, was around 2 years old. And while he's in Toronto, Cyril comes across the sort of evidence of a boy who was born in Toronto in the very early 1920s, who also happened to be mixed race and had a white mother who had abandoned him and a black father who had disappeared somewhere early on. That little boy was Edward, and it's Cyril's search for Edward that takes us through the book. And in many ways, it's a sort of it's coming of age, a year for Cyril. The year is 2012 in Toronto, but also a look back at Edward's history in Canada.
How long did it take you to write this novel?
I'm asked that question and I can't really answer it because the novel has sort of languished for many years in a file on my computer. I wrote 2 or 3 drafts and was very happy with the most recent draft, but couldn't find a publisher. So it was 10 years, I think, between the sort of start of that, the writing and the actual publication.
Inspired you to write this novel, specifically about your main character finding this boy, in the 1920s?
I should say that I am mixed race myself. My dad was black Jamaican. My mother was white English. They both have both died. And I had a very happy childhood and came to Canada myself when I was about 17 with my family from England. So I have the immigrant experience to some degree, but mine was a very easy transition, I think. But I was very curious over time, sort of thinking about the black experience in Canada and how fraught it can be for so many people, and how indeed things seem to change, but they don't change. So really everything changes and nothing changes. Sort of starting point. I wanted to know not just about the black experience in Canada over time, but also really question what it means to be brown, what it means to be of a mixed ethnicity. And there are so many of us, of course, in Canada now, well, certainly in Toronto and Montreal and other places, and I really wanted to ask questions about what that means, and I really enjoyed doing that research.
In writing this novel, were you able to find any answers to these questions you were writing about?
I don't know that I have any answers. I still believe that while everything seems to change, many things don't really change. They seem to change on the surface, but so I think a lot of things. I certainly don't have any answers there. And in terms of what it means to be brown, I think that's a conversation that needs to be that needs to be ongoing. And I mean, it's really obviously an important question as we sort of, as a society, try and figure out, you know, help people sort of understand, I think, what systemic racism is. I think that's not a term that's necessarily well understood, and I think we would all of us be better off if we understood it, could sort of confront it and overturn it. And I sure don't have any answers, but I'm really very interested in the conversation. And one of the things that I really have enjoyed about having this book published is the conversation that comes with it. So many people have said to me, having read the book, you know, there are things that they've simply never thought about. And I think, and I feel really, really pleased to have, you know, encouraged that sort of new thinking. Amazing though it seems, you know, these are simply issues that lots of people don't reflect upon at all. Of course, the reason they've started that sort of thinking is because there are two characters in the book who I think are very accessible for everybody. And they make that kind of reflection and consideration possible. Or so I'm told by readers, and I really appreciate that.
Did you ever imagine that your debut novel would make it onto this list?
No. I'm so pleased by what's happened with the novel since it was published. I didn't anticipate any of it. I was so very, very pleased to have it published at all. So just the idea of seeing the book in physical form, actually holding it in my hand, was a thrill, and I really didn't think beyond that at all. So what's happened for it since then has been just so exciting, and I'm so pleased. And I know how unusual it is, and I really appreciate that. So it's been a great experience.
For our bookshop show this week at Viewpoints, thanks to our journalist Owen Thompson and Candace Vedder, and to our national editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner, who are working very hard with their team of some 30 journalists editing stories from coast to coast. Meet up with them daily at canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. Lots of stories waiting for you there. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company. Stay tuned to the show that follows. See you next week. Ciao.
Listen to all of our news online at canada-info.ca.